Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. COVID-19 has the world in its grip. The spread of the virus is rampant, and it has sent the economy into a tailspin. And on top of that, we're in the middle of a political year with a lot at stake. On this Politics Monday, we take a look at how this virus intersects with politics and what its impact may be on the primaries that remain, on the Republican National Convention coming to Charlotte, and on the November election. But we start with a conversation with North Carolina 12th District Congresswoman Alma Adams to get an update on measures being taken in Congress to blunt the economic impact of the virus and to help businesses and individuals find a way through this mess. Congresswoman, welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you, Mike. I'm happy to be here, and thank you for having me on today.
You're very welcome. Let's talk about a success first. The House, which is controlled by Democrats, passed a relief bill last weekend. It took the Republican-controlled Senate nearly half a week to get that bill ready for the president's signature, but he has signed it. Other relief bills are in the pipeline. This one, the one that passed a week ago, is being described as a bipartisan effort. All of this is being described as a bipartisan effort, actually. Is it?
Oh, yes, it is. As a matter of fact, that bill passed with only 40 people not voting for it. So that clearly was a bipartisan effort, and it needs to be. This is not a partisan situation. It's certainly the outbreak isn't a partisan issue. It's a life and death issue, and I think the House and Senate understand that.
The bill that passed through the House last weekend and finally passed the Senate on Wednesday provides free testing and paid leave for certain workers. Can you be more specific about how that bill works to help people?
Well, for example, we have a number of people here in North Carolina who do not have health insurance. So this bill will not discriminate. If you don't have health insurance, if you are uninsured, then this is free testing for everybody who needs it. There will also be paid emergency leave and enhanced unemployment insurance, as well as providing the necessities in terms of food security for vulnerable people in our community. We do have an issue of food insecurity in the 12th District, and we want to make sure that people have what they need. There's also in this bill more federal funds for Medicaid. I mean, I personally still think that we need to expand Medicaid in North Carolina. We've got 400,000 people who are without health insurance, and so I think this would be a great opportunity to do that. But this bill doesn't do that, but it provides more federal funds for Medicaid.
How do these vulnerable individuals who will be benefited by the bill that just passed and was signed by the president, how will they come into contact with this money? What do they have to do to get the help they need that is provided in this bill?
Well, the various agencies will be reaching out to individuals. As a matter of fact, I've just mentioned that I'm hosting a teletown hall this evening, and we will have this will be one of the issues that will be talked about in terms of the various departments here that will be working with folks to make sure that they have what they need. You also know that we've made provisions, or certainly our school system, CMS, has made provisions for students who are on free and reduced lunch, who actually get their meals sometimes from school. They've made provisions for those parents and those children as well. So we'll have someone from CMS speaking with us as well on this evening.
And how do people access that?
Oh, okay. Well, the teletown hall begins at 6 o'clock, and they can call in to, looking for the number, they can call in to 704. No, that's not it. gosh. I'll find it before
all right.
We get all out.
We'll get one of our producers to give us that number later, and we'll put it on our website for you. Over the weekend, the Senate was working on a giant $1.8 trillion stimulus bill, which they said included many of the priorities the Democratic lawmakers had. But it appears that the Senate and House are headed in different directions on this. At one point yesterday, I think yesterday morning, what the sticking point appeared to be a $425 billion pool of money for loans and loan guarantees that the Washington Post said Democrats were labeling a slush fund because Steve Mnuchin's Treasury Department would have broad discretion over who receives that money. Talk about that. What's the dividing line between Republicans and Democrats on this?
Well, first of all, we don't believe that there needs to be a slush fund that Secretary Mnuchin would control. It's based on the information that I have, it would be a slush fund for corporations and would not be oversight. I mean, who's going to, and he will determine based on the language who gets it. So we don't think that that's necessary. We've got to put people first. We've got to make sure that people's houses and properties are not foreclosed on. We've got to give relief to our citizens who are suffering, and there's no need for this. I understand it's something like $500 billion. That's a lot of money for one person to be controlling anyway, but that money can be put to better use. So that's one of the things that we're opposed to. The bill also didn't include the funding for state and local governments. It did not include additional SNAP funds. Again, we are talking about people who are affected not only by this virus, but who are also affected by the hunger that we already have existing. It does not provide for what we're looking at, 3 months of unemployment insurance, funds for the uninsured, and adequate relief overall for the 44 million Americans with student loans. So we want a response to this virus that rises to the severity of the challenge. And so we've got to make sure that we do that and that we put our workers first and families.
I don't know if I'm right about this, so correct me if I'm wrong. I understood that yesterday one of the concerns that some Democrats have is that this bill that the Senate is haggling over at the moment, there are few, if any, controls over how the businesses who get this money are allowed to use it. So businesses could, if I'm not mistaken, there's some fear that businesses could use this money to pay bonuses or buy back stock. Is that true?
Well, that's right. There are no provisions in this bill that would prohibit that.
Is that deliberate?
Well, I think so. we don't need that. Yeah, we don't need that. We need to make sure if we're going to provide support for our businesses, and I believe we do need to do that, because they employ people, but we don't want them to come in and reduce their workers and fire people, and then use the money to enhance their top folks and give them bonuses and those kinds of things. And we've seen that in the past, so we're very leery of that. We certainly don't think that needs to happen, and we are very concerned about it. And yes, you're right. The bill does not prohibit those kinds of things from happening.
So this bill is designed to help individuals and businesses. We have to protect businesses, because if we don't, they'll go out of business, and there won't be any businesses for people to go back to work to. On the other hand, we have to help individuals who are really going to be severely impacted by this. Is there enough money to do both?
Well, I think we do have enough money to do both. We have to be, I think we have to prioritize in the right way. But we've got to put our workers and our families first. And you're right. I don't have any problem with supporting our businesses. Of course, they support our communities and they provide workers with jobs and so forth. So that, we're not opposed to that.
Right.
But we just believe that needs to be fair and level.
So one of the criticisms that President Obama and others in his administration faced during the 2008 economic downturn was that the government bailed out General Motors and the banks, while those losing their homes to foreclosure were left out in the cold. But the businesses that the government bailed out paid back those loans with interest. The government was made whole, and they made a profit at this. That can't happen this time, can it?
No, I don't believe so. But you know, I still think that if we're talking about and you know, you're using the word bailout, but we need to bail our communities out. We need to bail our workers out. We need to bail Main Street out. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at all of the mistakes that perhaps have been made in the past in terms of the funding that the federal government has provided. And we want to make sure that people are not left out in the cold. We want to make sure that they don't lose their homes. Many of them did. Some people have never recovered from that. And so it's just important that we do this the right way. And certainly we're trying to do it. Yes, we need to put money into the pockets of people. I think that's important as well. So we're working on all those things. And hopefully the Senate will come to some agreement with the House. If not, I suspect we're going to do our own bill.
The president has suggested that individuals receive $1,000 to $1,200 each to tide them over. That kind of money won't even pay most people's rent. Is that a meaningful amount of money? What would be a meaningful amount of money in your mind? Or are we just throwing good money into the abyss?
Well, I don't think that's meaningful enough. And there have been a number of proposals from various committees out here. As a matter of fact, Financial Services we've put on the table $2,000. I think I've heard the Senate say $2,400 and $1,000 for each child. So there are different proposals out here in terms of what's finally going to be in the package. We don't know, but certainly I think there is agreement that there needs to be direct financial assistance to people who need it. That's people who need it. Certainly, the president shouldn't be getting $1,000, or none of his family, none of probably the Congress shouldn't either. But we need to make sure that the money is being used by the right people, and that we make those provisions for them.
Where's all this money coming from, and what will it do ultimately to our economy and to our government's ability to go forward with normal programs in normal times?
Well, you know, we have found we probably have a lot of usages of money in right now that probably we shouldn't be using for certain things. And I think if we go back and look and see how we're wasting money, if in fact we are. We're in a crisis right now, and I don't think that money should be the amount of money. We need to spend what we need to provide for the citizens of this country, and everybody is impacted. I mean, from small businesses to big businesses to individuals who own their own businesses to contractors to our veterans. I mean, on and on and on. I cannot think of anyone who will not be impacted and who has not been impacted. We've lost thousands of jobs. We've had more than 80,000 requests for unemployment just last week. Typically, and I'm talking about in our area, and typically it's something like 3,500. So you can look at that and to see that people are already out of work. I mean, it's like a ghost town around. Yeah. So we've got a lot of work to do. We clearly need to put partisanism over everything else.
Let me stop you there for a second. We have to take a break. We'll come back with a little bit more with Alma Adams, the 12th District Congresswoman from North Carolina, when we continue with Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's Politics Monday, and on this Politics Monday, we like everybody else, are upended by the COVID-19 contagion that's sweeping the country. And we're talking to 12th District Congresswoman Alma Adams about what's happening in the nation's capital about this and what she's working on as well. Yesterday, there were 273 COVID-19 cases reported in North Carolina this morning. That number stands at 307, 80 of them in Mecklenburg County. We have the highest number of cases in the state, and one half of those cases are with young people, 20 to 39 years old, who I think got the impression that they were not at risk for this virus. Clearly, they are. And our colleague, Representative Adams, at WSOC-TV, Joe Bruno, tweeted last week that Mecklenburg County Health Director Gibby Harris has heard several times from you. What have you and Ms. Harris been discussing?
Well, first of all, I want to just shout out to our county and our city and all of our elected officials, our governor, and all who we've all been working together. We've tried to respond to questions that may have come in to the local offices. We have our website up, and we have a lot of information on there that people can use to contact different agencies and so forth. But basically, trying to let people know, for example, that we did send requests not only to our state legislature and our governor to make sure that people were not disconnected in terms of their rents and that kind of thing, and then of course our mayor issued her suggestion for no cutoffs of water and utilities for people. So we wanted people to have some assurance that we are working. Not only are we working together, but we're trying to make sure that we can get through this situation so that during this crisis period that people would not have to worry about those things. They've lost their jobs, but yet we want to make sure that they are staying in. We've asked people to stay in, so we've got to make people whole as a result.
Right. You've called for a nationwide suspension of foreclosures. You say it's the right economic policy, the right public health policy, and the only just policy during this crisis. Where does that stand?
Well, I think the responses that we've gotten have been very positive. I think we don't know that there's been any kind of national directive given, but certainly we've gotten assurances from our state and local entities that we will not be doing that. We can't, you know, because we've got a lot of homeless people already. We need to make provisions for them as well. All of these things, in my opinion, should be included in any package that comes out of the U.S. Congress. So we're working on that. I think all those things are being considered, and these are some of the things that we are trying to negotiate for in the stimulus package that we're putting forth. I think it is so very, very critical that we do that and let people know. We've asked people to stay home, to stay in. We've asked businesses to close down. We don't want people on the streets. We want them to observe the social distancing that we've been talking about that will help preserve not only their health, but the health of other people.
We're hearing dire reports from medical people across the country about a lack of equipment, a lack of personal safety equipment, masks and visors and things like that. And we keep getting mixed messages. Sometimes governors say we need the federal government's help. The federal government seems to be saying you're on your own. Governors, you do it better than we do it, so go ahead and do it. What are you hearing about the conditions with medical professionals here in Mecklenburg County?
Well, I've been following all of the press conferences that the president has had over these weeks. We're hearing that as our numbers increase, of course, we're going to need more support. I think it's really a national shame that our first responders, that our medical folks who are taking care of all of these sick people with this virus don't have the equipment that they need. And the president keeps talking about, oh, they're coming, but not giving any specifics. And then when you hear the government, and I do think that it is the federal government, I think we need to be providing that oversight and not just totally relying on these on the governors and the mayors or the governors to do it, because there's a lot of competition out there. They're saying that they're competing with other governors and other states and that kind of thing. So if we had, if the president then would issue a national order, then I think we would have an opportunity to kind of get things back to where they should be. But our folks who are helping to our health individuals are getting sick. And so if they're sick, then who will take care of the sick and who will take care of them? So it is a problem. And I do think we can do better, in my opinion.
12th District, North Carolina, 12th District Congresswoman, Alma Adams. Thank you so much for taking some time and talking to us this morning. I appreciate it.
And thank you so much, Mike. I appreciate it. We've left the call number for tonight's teletown hall. If people want to join us, we'd appreciate it.
Okay. Hang on the line. Our producers will get that from you, okay?
Okay.
Thank you. So now on to politics and the impact of this pandemic on the upcoming primaries and the election, not just how this may affect the thinking of voters, but how we hold an election in an age of quarantine and shelter in place. Dr. Michael Bitzer is the chair of the Department of Politics at Catawba College, who also writes the Old North State Politics blog. Welcome back, Michael.
Good to be with you.
Dr. Amber Wichowski is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University, where she is also the director of the Marquette Democracy Lab. Thank you for being a first-timer with us this morning.
Great. Thank you for having me.
And Mac McCorkle is director of the Center for Political Leadership, Innovation, and Service at Duke University and a frequent issues consultant to political candidates, state governments, and other organizations in 28 states, including our own. Thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
So, Michael, 2 weeks ago, we witnessed an incredible come-from-behind victory by Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden, followed by wins in three primaries that followed the Super Tuesday primaries. And now, like most everything else in America, the presidential campaign has come to a screeching halt. Will the rest of the election and the outcome be determined by COVID-19 and how it impacts Americans and how the president's administration handles it? Will this be the determining factor in November?
I don't think anybody can necessarily predict what will happen in November. I think a lot of us are still trying to understand how long this virus will last. Will it last through the summer? Will it impact potentially the nominating conventions, both the DNC and the RNC, that's scheduled to be held in Charlotte? All plans right now seem to be that they are going to go ahead and hold them. But this is a major disruption. And I'm trying to recall, other than economic calamities like 2008 and the Great Recession, what has impacted a presidential election to this scale? And I think we are in historic times, and we potentially don't know what's going to happen come the fall, because could the virus go away and then come back in the fall again? I think we're just dealing with a bunch of unknowns at this time.
So, Mac McCorkle, President Trump was able to crow until last week about record highs in the stock market, roaring economy, low unemployment, and now in just a week, all those gains the market made during his entire administration are gone. Unemployment is rapidly rising. Commerce has stopped. None of this is his fault. But normally, a collapsing economy would be a disaster for any incumbent. Will it be this time?
Hard to say. Right now, there's some evidence of a rally around the flag effect for to benefit President Trump, Governor Cooper, and almost all elected officials. We can't tell whether that's going to be a very temporary effect. Usually, an economic and health crisis calamity like this would be very detrimental to an incumbent president. And at the very least, it may be hard for the president to go forth with happy days are here and touting his accomplishments. Mm-hmm. So I agree with Michael. It's hard to say, but it probably is not a good development for President Trump's reelection chances.
Well, Amber Wichowski, you told NPR that the economy can look very different depending on your perspective, and that Democrats and Republicans mm-hmm. often have a different perspective on the economy. Do they now?
Yeah.
I mean, does it count in times like these?
Absolutely. So one of the big unknowns is what political polarization means for all of this. So the quote that you were that you just referenced was about the fact that depending on which party is in power, co-partisans can look at the economy is doing really well if their team is in power, or that it's doing terribly if their team is not in power. We've seen some of this polarization play out in the ways in which partisanship serves as almost a perceptual screen, biasing kind of how we see objective reality. We see a little bit of this in terms of Americans' initial reactions to the public health crisis. So Brian Schaffner has some really interesting data that he put out there looking at just Google searches for hand sanitizer and showing that it was much greater in areas where Trump did poorly, and that those searches were much lower in areas where Trump did well. Now, he's been tracking this over time and showing that that kind of partisan differentiation is actually reduced a bit, perhaps as more of the country becomes kind of aware and alarmed about the escalating crisis. So that's a big unknown, is what partisanship is going to mean, whether or not the country blames the incumbent president for the handling of the crisis, or whether or not this remains seen as kind of a partisan divide, with Democrats being kind of consistently opposed and Republicans rallying around the president.
Yeah, but we had the president, at least initially, gave out a rosier picture than it's actually turning out to be in terms of the impact this virus would have. And right-wing media followed suit. They supported him in that effort. And now the chickens are coming home to roost, so perhaps more Republicans are seeing the need for hand sanitizer and other things. But how does this theory that Democrats and Republicans see the economy differently and see the world differently apply, Amber, to independents?
Oh, that's a good question. So I want to say one thing about partisans before independents, which is voters overwhelmingly take cues from elites. So I think some of the uncertainty that I have about how polarization is going to play out has to do with what our political elites are going to do and say. And here we're seeing some indications, at least within the states, in which polarization is playing out somewhat differently, where you've got states like Wisconsin, where we've got a Democrat governor, Republicans control the state legislature, really coming around one single message of bipartisanship and dealing with the crisis. Now, independents have been negative toward Trump, more so in some states than others. Independents are a smart, small but very important slice of the electorate if we think about the voters who swing. And these are the types of voters that do tend to be affected by shifts in the economy. They are less likely to have that partisanship motivated reasoning that we see, partisanship kind of play. And so to be affected by shifts in political events and in the economy. So I expect that depending how this plays out, and again, this is a big unknown, that this puts Trump's reelection in doubt.
Here's some more unknowns, Dr. Bitzer. Donald Trump was hoping to run against socialism, the brand that Bernie Sanders was pushing, and on continuing to drain the swamp. But now Bernie's out. Trump is using big government to rein in this corona crisis. And in the absence of all the economic positives that he could point to just 2 weeks ago, what does he run on now?
That's a great question. I think, you know, for most presidents who are confronting a crisis of this scale and magnitude, what they want to show is leadership. What they want to show is assuredness to the public. What they want to show is confidence in the experts who know and understand things like public health. And the concern that I have, and you're already starting to see advertisements going out online is the miscommunications by the president over time as to how many cases we are going to be dealing with. At one point, he said, maybe there will be a miracle and nothing, you know, all the cases will go away. That kind of off-the-cuff kind of gut response when not following the expertise and the knowledge of experts really will come back to haunt the president in advertising, in ways of the Democrats being able to show that there was indeed a lack of competency by the president, who is indeed the nation's leader. That will probably be the referendum by which a lot of voters may be deciding this November's election.
Yeah, and Mac, USA Today ran an article about this in their money section, I think last week. It was headlined, "Can the Economy Predict the Next President? Yes, if history is any indication." And the article goes on to say that the economy predicted the winner of 16 of the previous 18 elections in which an incumbent was running. But we've got a double whammy here. We've got an economic impact caused by a medical situation that is unprecedented. So will the outcome of this election be determined more on economic factors or on what Michael just talked about, how this crisis is handled by this administration?
Well, it's always a combination, almost always, certainly. Herbert Hoover depression gets blamed on the Herbert Hoover. But it's a little more complicated than that in most cases. And I think the main point is simply that no matter how this comes out, it's hard to see how Trump is going to be able to present something in an optimistic vein about his accomplishments and his administration in November. Now, if the economy comes back and we dodge the bullet and by August things are coming back, that may be different, but it does look troublesome for him. I would say the one caveat to that is we're not seeing that problem for Trump in the job approval numbers right now. But again, that seems to be a rally around the flag crisis mode. So we won't really know how the American public is looking at this probably for another couple weeks or whether he's really taking on damage. I agree with the other two commentators. You would think that he is either either suffering or will suffer from what the advertising will be about him in the fall.
There's a lot more to talk about with regard to the coronavirus's intersection with politics and the 2020 election, and we'll get to that when we come back with our three guests in the remaining part of the program here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking with three political scientists about the impact of COVID-19 on the 2020 election. Mac McCorkle is director of the Center for Political Leadership, Innovation, and Service at Duke University. Dr. Amber Wachowski is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University, where she's also the director of the Marquette Democracy Lab. And Dr. Michael Bitzer is chair of the Department of Politics at Catawba College, who writes the Old North State Politics blog. We've talked a lot about how Donald Trump is being impacted by this, but what about the Democrats? Because it would seem to me to be very difficult for Democrats to run against an incumbent president who is struggling, as any incumbent president would be, with this unprecedented economic and medical situation. Joe Biden has virtually disappeared since the last primaries, even as Donald Trump has been sending out mixed messages, many of which counter health professionals. Essentially telling the country, I am not a shipping clerk. So should Joe Biden be more assertive? Should he be a shadow presidential figure offering suggestions on how a Biden administration would be handling this? Or is he doing the right thing by just getting out of the way, Michael?
I think certainly, you know, Democrats are going to want to hear from Joe Biden. And I think what they're trying to do is dramatically reshape their campaign. I mean, we can't understand the impact of being able to hold rallies, being able to get free media from those rallies, being able to do the things that normal campaigns rely on. It is now an entirely new ballgame. And I think what the Biden campaign early on just last week did was send out a video by Ron Klain, who was working with the campaign, who did a lot of public health crisis management under the Obama administration. And so I think you'll start to see surrogates for Biden come out. But my understanding is Biden is basically ramping up a kind of campaign screening room in his house to be able to start to send out videos, to be able to hold press conferences, to have the kind of normalcy that a campaign would have.
But the president is getting hours of television every single day at these necessary White House briefings. How do you combat that?
I think, you know, certainly he's going to have to step up his public appearances and make it much more, perhaps bring in a shadow kind of health cabinet and advisors around him to rely on that kind of surrogacy. But certainly this is, yes, the president does have the bully pulpit. He does rally the attention of the media. All the networks have been covering the press conferences. It's almost as if Donald Trump is using the press conference time as kind of a surrogate for his rallies himself. Perhaps Biden needs to do the same thing.
So because of this coronavirus outbreak, the governor of Ohio postponed his state primary despite court rulings insisting that they go ahead with it. Now, six other states, Connecticut, Georgia, Indiana, Louisiana, Kentucky, and Maryland, have postponed their presidential primaries. Amber, what happens if other states act similarly or if these primaries cannot be held as planned? Because the Democrats have a rule that all of their primaries have to be completed by June the 9th. If that date can't be met, can the Democratic Party legitimately nominate a candidate?
Goodness, this is such a good question and a lot of unknowns here. So I'm in Wisconsin, and just this past week, we had a court ruling that the state is to reinstate online voter registration. So that had ended, meaning that if voters wanted to register to vote, in order to even to request an absentee ballot, they would have to go in person. So that has been reversed. That Wisconsin is reopening online voter registration. And voters here have until, I believe, April 2nd, to request an absentee ballot for our April 7th primary. So here in Wisconsin, folks are urging voters to request those absentee ballots and to limit going to the polls and putting more elderly poll workers, who tend to be the ones volunteering and performing that civic duty, at risk. So huge unknowns here about whether or not this is going to proceed. I think there's real concern among many political scientists are signing petitions and talking about, you know, what steps states and the federal government, Congress, should be taking or thinking about, not just for the primary elections, but even thinking about the November general election as well. In terms of how this would impact the Democratic Party and their nomination, you're absolutely right in terms of what, in terms of the existing rules, this means. I'm going to defer to others in terms of what the party might do in these sort of extraordinary times. But even thinking about the national convention that we're scheduled here to have in Milwaukee, lots of questions about whether or not this will continue as planned. There's a lot that we don't know about COVID-19 and how it's going to play out here in the country, whether or not it recedes a bit when the weather warms. But lots of unknowns about what this means for the Democratic Party.
Well, we're having the other convention here, allegedly. We'll see what happens, I suppose, as the president likes to say. But, Mac, I mean, is there, if you can't hold the Republican convention and you can't hold the Democratic convention, can you have an election?
Yes. I it will be unprecedented, but I think yes. And, you know, we probably will have televised conventions or some kind of substitute for those pageants. Hard to see how a lot of business will get done at a convention, but that's not that much business has been getting done at conventions for a long period of time. I think it is beneficial for the Democrats that the race is pretty well determined. That, you know, think about this situation dealing with the suspension of rules and everything else in 2016 when Clinton and Sanders were still in a pitched battle and unable to the party probably unable to make these kind of rule changes that would be necessary. My instinct is that while there still be some awkwardness, that the party could make the changes simply because it's been so decisive. Biden's surprise comeback has been so decisive that I don't think that Sanders people will right. that will be a deadlock.
The New York Times ran an editorial yesterday saying, urging elections officials across the country to start planning for mail-in ballot election or making it easier to choose between going to the polls and using a mail-in ballot. I suppose that's up to individual states or individual election districts. I believe, Michael, Oregon's elections are conducted by mail-in ballots. Are those elections considered to be successful, safe? Is there any other way to hold an election during a contagion like this?
Yeah, it's not just Oregon. It's Colorado. It's Hawaii, okay. Washington, and Utah. California is actually, after this year's election, planning to go to the option of counties having all absentee election ballots. Here in North Carolina, typically in a presidential year, you'll see about 5% of the ballots come absentee by mail. There's also absentee in-person, one-stop, and then election day voting. I think, you know, the call from a lot of political scientists who study election administration to the states, and remember, it is the states that administer elections through the counties, is that they need to start planning now for elections possibly all done by mail. It can be done because voter registration rolls have all of the addresses. Mail-out ballots can be sent to every one of the nearly 7 million registered North Carolina voters, and that can be done. We could have a very expansive time period by which in order to implement by mail, but it's going to require some prep work being done now.
But there is no way, because there are rumors floating around that the president could cancel this election. There is no way, am I correct, that the general election can be canceled or even postponed?
I believe it would take an act of Congress to be able to do that, and I doubt seriously the House Democrats would allow that.
Okay. Yep. Amber, you study electorate behavior, and you've said mm-hmm. that in the 2012 election, according to a study conducted by Marquette, homeowners who lost their homes following the Great Recession or who were facing crisis-related foreclosures were less likely to vote. How might that impact either this election or politicians who may view this as a way to skew the election in their favor?
Right. So I've written quite a bit about the role of the economy and economic hardship on voter turnout. So the study that you were citing was about voters who were facing foreclosure. And what we showed was that for individuals facing foreclosure, there's a drop in the likelihood that they would turn out to vote in the general election in November. Now, context also matters, though. So individuals who are facing economic hardship on their own tend to withdraw from political life. They tend to not vote. However, we're in unprecedented times. And there's also research, including studies that I've done, showing that when unemployment rates rise dramatically, you can actually get some upticks in turnout as more worried voters kind of think about voicing their concerns and seeking remedies. But of course, this gets really complicated for the reasons that we were just talking about in terms of election administration. So how the economy is going to play out, I think, is a big unknown in terms of voter turnout. You might have people just consumed by the challenges of making ends meet, putting food on the table, providing for their families, not thinking about politics, yeah. Not having the time, the bandwidth. On the other hand, it might actually lead to upticks. And then finally, the question about what do groups and parties do to mobilize the electorate. So right now, we don't have the ground game, the door-to-door canvassing that you usually have in an election year that helps to mobilize the electorate. Right now, that is on pause in terms of face-to-face door-to-door canvassing here and banking and the like.
We lost you for that last part of that comment. I'm not going to ask you to repeat it because we're short on time, but I'm sorry that happened. How might this impact down ballot races? Mac, this is an important election year. The Democrats want to take back the Senate and keep the House. They want the White House too, but how might the actions of this Congress passing all these bills to help business and individuals impact the down ballot races?
You would think, that the polarization that we've been talking about will still dictate that the down ballot races in most states, in most cases, will track pretty closely what's happening at the top of the ticket in the presidential race. There could be, though, varying effects. For instance, there would be support for all the incumbents, or there could be support or hostility towards all incumbents that cut across party lines. So I would still think that the ideological partisan polarization that we're seeing will dictate that the down ballot races, again, are more and more following the trend of what's happening at the national level. But there's a counter possibility that you could have support for incumbents or opposition for incumbents cross that polarization so that you could see support, for instance, in North Carolina for a Governor Cooper and a Trump. That's hard to imagine given all the polarization we've been going through, but I think it's at least a possibility.
Is this going to be trickier for Tea Party members of Congress who got elected because of what Barack Obama and his bunch did to bail out banks and Wall Street? And now they're in a position of having to bail out the country. Is it going to be tougher for them? Because are their constituents going to understand why are you turning tail and doing what they did before?
Yeah, I think that in particular the so-called the Republican Freedom Caucus, the most conservative faction in the House, has grown quiet. Mark Meadows from North Carolina, former congressman, is now chief of staff Trump. And I think it's fascinating to watch, even though it's not as important as everything else is going on, is with the stimulus package and what's going on in Washington, whether ideology Trump's thing, so to speak, or whether necessity of getting stimulus happens so much so that a lot of maybe conservative notions are thrown out of the window for the time being. So I think that's you're seeing that right now, I think, with this today on the stimulus package. Where is Trump going to end up? Where is going to be the sweet spot that passes this legislation? Because it will be hell to pay if the legislation doesn't pass. So where does that happen? And I think you're not seeing a lot of conservative bromides being passed about debt relief and about growing debt and other things in this debate.
We have about a minute left. And Amber, I'm curious about this because the Tea Party Republicans were voted in, and so was Donald Trump, in a lot of populist anger. And last week it was revealed that Richard Burr, North Carolina Senator Richard Burr, used insider trading, allegedly, to trade stocks because of his advanced knowledge of what this coronavirus was going to do. And he was not alone. Other members of Congress, including Democrat Dianne Feinstein's husband, also allegedly did this. Could this play a role in the election and in the down ballot races? Could this fuel the populist anger already abundant in the country and deepen the divide further?
Sure, it could. Scandals, can hurt incumbents. And when you've got close races where everything is going to matter, turnout, the economy, it's all going to matter. You could have scandals such as these make the difference, tip the scales. Whether or not collectively the country looks at these sorts of questions and blames, let's say, the Trump administration or blames the party of these incumbents is unknown at this point.
Amber Wichowski is a professor of political science at Marquette University and the director of the Marquette Democracy Lab. Mac McCorkle is director of the Center for Political Leadership, Innovation, and Service at Duke University. And Michael Bitzer is professor of political science and chair of the Department of Politics at Catawba College. Thank you all for being with us from wherever you are this morning, and stay safe. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.